The Employment Roundtable podcast is produced by the Gable Gottwals Law Firm. The Employment Roundtable is provided for educational and informational purposes only and does not contain legal advice or create an attorney-client relationship. The information provided should not be taken as an indication of future legal results. Any information provided should not be acted upon without consulting legal counsel. Welcome to the Employment Roundtable, where we provide you with the perspectives and information you need to make wise employment decisions for your employees and your organizations. I'm your host, Talitha Ebright, and today we're talking with Holly Cole, Director of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Oklahoma, and my Gable Gottwals partner, Paula Williams, about EEOC position statements. So Paula, let's get started with you. What is an EEOC position statement, and what kind of timeframes do employers have to submit their position statements?
Thanks, Talitha. So to answer that question, we have to take one step back and ask, what is a charge of discrimination? Because the EEOC position statement is the employer's response to an employee or former employee's charge of discrimination. When an employee or former employee believes they've been discriminated against, they go to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is a federal agency that exists to help prevent discrimination in the workplace. We have a number of federal statutes in our country that prevent discrimination for a number of reasons, race, religion, disability, the list goes on and on. So when an employee goes to the EEOC, they're going to fill out information for the EEOC that ultimately lands in a charge of discrimination. The EEOC provides the charge of discrimination to employers through a notice of a charge. And when employers receive that notice, they know when the alleged discrimination happened. They know what basis the employee is claiming discrimination, such as sex or disability. And they know a general summary of what the employee or former employee says happened. The employer then has a chance to put its own version of the facts into a position statement, which it provides to the EEOC. Now, usually you're going to do this in the first 30 to 60 days after you get that charge. So employers need to move quickly. In my experience, the EEOC has been willing to work with us when we need a little bit more time, but usually we try to be very responsive and cooperative with the EEOC in responding to those charges.
Okay, great. And now, so we just talked about the relatively short time frame that employers have to respond to those charges of discrimination. You know, in light of that short time frame, I know that it's important that employers be very careful still with how they respond. Why is it so important that they be careful in their responses?
Yeah, so the EEOC provides guides that help respondents respond in a way that the EEOC wants. And what they want is to be provided factually specific position statements that address each allegation that the employee or former employee has made against the employer. We want to show the EEOC that there's no reasonable cause to believe that a violation has occurred to prevent further investigation by the EEOC. Because if the EEOC determines it's warranted, they can issue their own requests and seek additional information from the employer. You know, last but not least, this is a matter of personal preference, but to every extent I can, I want to make sure I know all the facts at the EEOC stage, because we need to live by what we say in that position statement. We don't want to provide one reason for termination at the termination and a different reason for termination in the position statement and a third reason for termination in a lawsuit. We want to make sure that we are as comprehensive as possible, that we understand what happened so that we can provide the EEOC a full history of what led to the employment decision.
Thanks, Paul. And you've given us a little bit of a preview into sort of what you like to provide to the EEOC in a position statement. But what does your process look like for sort of gathering that information and putting that together?
Sure. So first, I'm going to talk to employers about who the key players are. I want to know who is managing the employee, who is evaluating the employee, who is coaching the employee, who is the decision maker on the employment decision. I need to know whether they are current employees still with the organization, or whether we have former employees involved in this. I want to know what key policies there are. If an employer has policies but hasn't been actually implementing them and using them, we need to know that. We need to know if this employee's or former employee's experience differs from other people that are currently at the organization. I want to work with the employer on constructing a timeline of what happened so that everyone is clear, again, on that history of the facts, so that we know everything that led to that decision. Certainly some employment decisions are very quick. Something very big happened, and that timeline is very short because something very big, let's say fraud or embezzlement, this is why they got fired. But more often, it's a long course of events that led to the employment decision. Hopefully, the employer has been documenting that long course of events and communicating to the employee throughout the process so that the employment decision shouldn't have been a surprise. If they've been documenting and communicating, that also helps make my job easier when I start to reconstruct that for a position statement. Once I've got a handle on, you know, who made the decision, what the decision was, why they made the decision, who else was involved in the decision, I want to gather relevant documents because that position statement is also going to provide the EEOC evidence. I'm going to pull performance evaluations. I'm going to pull absences that were documented, timekeeping records, internal complaints about the employee, or internal complaints made by the employee. I'm going to look for communications like emails and notes. I may even ask former or key players like current employees to provide affidavits to help support our version of what happened. This kind of evidence is going to be attached to the position statement for the EEOC to help support what in the legal world we call our legitimate non-discriminatory reasons for the employment decision.
Great. Thanks so much, Paula. That's really helpful to understand that process. And so let's switch gears a little bit. We've looked at what it looks like from the employer's perspective to receive the charge and how, you know, lawyers helping the employer can put together the position statement. But Holly, you see those position statements from sort of the other side of the table. How does the EEOC use position statements, and what are the hallmarks of particularly effective position statements?
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Talitha, for inviting me to talk about this topic today. I would encourage everyone to check out the EEOC's guidance on how to prepare an effective position statement that sets forth the expectations that we would have, and that's going to be on EEOC.gov. But Paula's spot on. The things that she mentioned, overall, we are looking for a fact-based position statement. And by that, I mean it's based on evidence. It's based on the facts of what happened. And so Paula mentioned the things that she wants to gather and she wants to present, and she's right. Things like timelines, an account of the events that happened, names of witnesses, anything that helps the EEOC investigator know more about the situation. This is the respondent's first opportunity to tell their side of the story. And often it's the last opportunity because of the thoroughness of what they have provided. The investigator is able to make some conclusions and reach some determinations as to what happened solely based on the information the charging party initially provided and then the respondent's position statement. Position statements that are not factually based are the ones that are based on argument. We see the ones that are just want to point out the weaknesses of the charging party's claim or just want to talk about the strengths of the respondent's defenses. Those are not very helpful in helping the investigator know what happened. So sometimes it's important for the respondent to put some background information into a position statement so that everything can be viewed in context. and that's fine. But the position statements that are long and rambling and have little to no bearing on the actual allegations of the charge, those aren't very helpful in helping the investigator figure out what happened. And there might even be an inference drawn that you do not have any supporting evidence to support the respondent's position in that situation. The other thing that can happen too is, you know, then there's a second request for information, and it's longer, and it takes more time to gather the documents and all that. So it's not only more work for the respondent to gather that information, but it also takes more time. So factually responding to the allegations to the extent that you can, and making sure that you have your opportunity, the respondent has their opportunity to tell their side of the story. And then to the timeliness issue, we've definitely have some flexibility on that in those situations where there are a lot of documents, there's a lot of information that we're going to need. And so if that request for an extension of time is made, you know, early on, then those are typically granted. So, but, you know, the EEOC wants to conduct timely and efficient investigations because old evidence doesn't help anyone. It's not beneficial to any of the parties for investigations to drag on and on. My boss likes to say, evidence is not like fine wine. It does not get better with age. So we like to move things along.
I like that. I'm going to start using that. Going to figure out a place to put it in somewhere. All right. Well, thanks so much. That perspective is really helpful, Holly. Thank you very much. Now, Paula, in light of what Holly just explained about, you know, what's helpful to the EEOC and sort of what she and the EEOC are looking for, what types of circumstances make it particularly challenging for you to prepare effective position statements on behalf of your employer clients?
First, I'll say that my prior answer about all the things I ask, and hopefully the employer has been documenting and communicating. If that's not in the file, then it gets more difficult for me. So if I asked you in, 9 months from now, what we talked about on this podcast, you would remember. But if I asked you right after this podcast to write down 5 sentences of what we talked about, they're probably going to be much more accurate than when I ask you in 9 months. So that makes it more difficult when I'm trying to help an employer reconstruct a version of events that they're trying to recall. Sometimes we get that charge of discrimination very quickly after the event happens, but employees have up to a year in Oklahoma particularly, and that can differ by state, but generally a year in Oklahoma, to file that. So sometimes we're quite down the road from when the event happened. The other thing that makes it difficult is if the charge is very vague. You just heard Holly say the employer responds to the extent they can. So sometimes a charge is very vague and very general. And I'll give an example. If someone's claiming sexual harassment and they say, my coworkers made comments of about my body and my manager knew about it. Okay, well, yes, I can go talk to the manager. And I can say, do you recall this? And I can interview the manager and start to try to gather facts. But when they've just named coworkers, let's say they work on a team of 20, all of a sudden it gets very difficult. You're interviewing 20 people to try to figure out, did anyone else hear the comments? Who was making the comments? If the manager doesn't know that information, then it's a lot harder for me to try to figure out the who, the what, the where, the when, to be able to actually respond to that in a way that the EEOC would expect.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. Now, Holly, you know, I know that all parties involved are interested in sort of resolving these issues, hopefully amicably. And to that end, how does the EEOC employ mediation in attempting to resolve disputes during the course of investigating employee charges?
So the EEOC's mediation program has been around since 1995. It was back then when it became really clear that alternative dispute resolution was a great tool to resolve, disputes of all kinds, right? And so especially in situations where an employee is still employed by the respondent, coming to a discussion early in that charge process can go a long way to mending that relationship and hoping that, you know, things can reach an amicable resolution and that employment relationship can continue. So the EEOC's mediation program has a lot of benefits. It's free, so it's no cost to either party. It is a neutral, confidential process that is completely separate from our investigative process. It is offered, you know, in those situations when it is offered, it's offered early on in the investigation, which saves parties time and money and helps before people are entrenched, you know, in their positions. It's certainly a less contentious process than the investigative process is. And it allows parties to craft their own resolution, their own solution to the situation. The mediator is there to facilitate that conversation, but not to issue any determinations or make any findings one way or another. And it's the statistic that I just saw, I think it's impressive. It speaks to the success of the EEOC's mediation program, is that since October of 2022, the national resolution rate is at 76%. So that's a really high resolution rate for any ADR program. And I think it benefits the EEOC and all the stakeholders that do business with us. And one more thing that is somewhat intangible, but I've heard my employment lawyer friends say that coming to the table and discussing a charge gives employers a different perspective as to what's going on in the workplace. And by that, I mean, they may learn things that are happening in the workplace that they didn't know about. Sometimes they're non-EEO matters, right? Sometimes they're not even part of the charge, but it's a good opportunity to kind of take the temperature of your workforce, and maybe you do have some issues that you would like to see done differently. So it's a good learning opportunity in that respect.
Yeah, that does sound great. And those statistics are very impressive. Now, Paula, in what circumstances is it in an employer's best interest to participate in the EEOC's mediation program?
Yeah, so I concur with everything Holly just said. I generally see very little downside to mediation if I think the parties are ready to talk about a charge and will both come to the table reasonably. Then I'm always willing to have settlement discussions. And even after mediation, especially if the other side is represented by counsel, those discussions can still continue. And so it may be a starting place to something that that settles eventually, where the parties reach an amicable resolution, even if they don't that day. There is a cost savings. You are still going to pay me if I'm headed to EEOC mediation with you. You will still have my costs, though it's going to be less than if I did all of the investigation I talked about beforehand and crafted that position statement. I will want to do some investigation because we want to know the strength of the employment decision and how firm of ground we stand on prior to going into the mediation room so that we've done some amount of risk evaluation before we do that. There are certainly instances where mediation may not be the right decision for the employer, though. And if I could speak to those for just a second,
yeah, please.
I mentioned that if the parties are both ready to sit down and reasonably negotiate, you know, if I have an employee that I think has maximum damages that are very low and they're wanting something in the six figures, then I shouldn't say never, you know, Holly just said 76% chance, but then I go, you know what? I think this is likely going to be in the 24% range, right? I'm not sure that this one is going to settle. I see a very low likelihood of settlement. Maybe the employer did an excellent job of documenting performance deficiencies and feels very good about their defense of the claim and wants to defend the claim and has an appetite to defend the claim. Then sometimes it is better to proceed and go to litigation, which ends up being an educational process for the other side as the employee starts to learn about all of the documented evidence that the employer had that that supported its decision. Certainly, I'm with Holly. If the parties can resolve something that early, that's always better than resolving it 9 months down the road when you've paid me a lot more money and you've had headaches and business interruption trying to get affidavits and documents for review. So there's a very high value towards settling early if the parties are both at a place to have that conversation reasonably.
Definitely. Great. Well, thanks to both of you, Holly and Paula. Lots of really, really good information here. I think the piece that was really new to me today and that was helpful to hear and understand was just how wide employers' initial investigations maybe should be, even if the charge itself isn't very specific or if the claims are narrow. You still want to have a pretty broad and wide investigation early just so that you don't later find yourself having to change horses in midstream. So I think that was useful to understand. Well, thank you to the listeners for listening to the Employment Roundtable. Please join us next time as we dig into the first of a three-part series about the intersection between employment and health. The Employment Roundtable podcast is produced by the Gable Gottwals Law Firm. The Employment Roundtable is provided for educational and informational purposes only and does not contain legal advice or create an attorney-client relationship. The information provided should not be taken as an indication of future legal results. Any information provided should not be acted upon without consulting legal counsel.